Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. We're the Council for the Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. And we're not the only ones, of course, sticking up for public education. There's a group called Save Our Schools up there in Canberra, and Jane Carrow has been holding the fort up there in Sydney. But we have a very interesting press release from Save Our Schools, from Trevor Cobold, where the independent schools have actually owned up to a major flaw in their funding model. There's a thing called bank grandparents that operates very well in favour of private schools. And we all know that private schools aren't about educating everyone the way the public schools are. And there's a fascinating article in Tuesday's June the 2nd's Age this week, where the private schools that have football teams, that is the best way, did you know, into the AFL, getting a job there. So it's jobs for the boys all the way. But the problem is that these football matches are so of so much interest to the people looking for jobs for the boys that they've got a betting site. Back your school and win real money. So private schools are about money and about sport, apparently, and well, certainly about who knows who. But public education is about educating all of our children and giving everyone an opportunity. So let's hear, shall we, from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Independent schools own up to a major flaw in the private school funding model. This is by Trevor Cobold, published on May the 26th. In an extraordinary development, Independent Schools Australia, ISA, has owned up to a fundamental flaw in how government funding of its schools is estimated. A media release issued by ISA reveals that 20% of families in independent schools receive financial support from other family members. It is an extraordinary admission because ISA is effectively admitting that its schools are overfunded. They are overfunded because income from other family members is not included in adjusted taxable family income, which is used to determine Commonwealth government funding of private schools. The median adjusted taxable income of parents in a private school determines the capacity to contribute CTC score, which in turn determines the base level of Commonwealth funding. Private schools are overfunded to the extent that income from other family members leads to underestimation of adjusted taxable income and the CTC score. The higher the proportion of students who have their fees partially or wholly paid by other family members, the greater the overfunding of a school. As a result, the extent of overfunding due to the Bank of Mum and Dad will vary between schools. The financial support from other family members is commonly referred to as the bank of mum and dad, grandparents, many of whom are likely to benefit from generous tax concessions. It can also include financial support from other relatives. The bank of mum and dad is a major source of supplementary non-taxable income for many families. Apart from the payment of school fees, this financial support includes money for house deposits, cars, household assets, childcare, holidays, etc. This other income support frees up family income to be spent on school fees. The admission by ISA that other family members contribute to the payment of private school fees follows similar admissions by some individual independent schools. Two Sydney elite private schools have admitted that many grandparents paid the school fees for students. A spokesman for St Joseph's College said, "We have seen an increase in recent years in grandparents wishing to support their grandchildren through high school by providing financial assistance with school fees." The headmaster at Knox Grammar said, "Anecdotally, Knox has always had a number of grandparents paying fees, and that number is probably increasing with changes in how people invest." He also said that grandparents also paid for other items, such as excursions. At another Sydney independent school, half of all fee invoices are sent directly to grandparents. It is difficult to estimate the extent to which grandparents pay school fees. However, surveys by financial services firms indicate that a significant proportion do so. For example, the Industry Superannuation Fund, REST, found that almost one-third of grandparents used their superannuation to pay school fees for grandchildren. A survey by the education finance company EdStart found that only half of families with children in private schools can afford the fees from their income, so it is hardly surprising that grandparents are helping. The Sydney Morning Herald reported that a Melbourne wealth management firm said that 70% of its clients are paying school fees for their grandchildren. It should be noted that ignoring income provided by other family members is just one source of overfunding of independent schools. Another major flaw in the private school funding model is that income of hundreds of millions from donations, investment income, and other income from rental properties and the hire of facilities is also ignored in determining government funding. In addition, data provided to Senate Budget Estimates 2025-26 by the Commonwealth Department of Education showed that independent and Catholic schools are overfunded in all states and territories under the current model. That was in answer to question on notice SQ25-000647. The confession by ISA and other substantial evidence that the Bank of Mum and Dad is a significant source of income for parents in private schools should prompt an urgent review of how private schools are funded by the Commonwealth Government. The failure to take this additional source of family income into account results in overfunding of private schools and significant waste of taxpayer resources. Such a review should lead to a new model for funding private schools to ensure they are funded solely according to need. The basic principle behind government funding of private schools should only be to fill any gap between the base schooling resource standard and income from fees and other private sources. This funding should be conditional on private schools meeting the same social obligations and standards as public schools. Schools with private income above the resource standard should not be entitled to baseline government funding because it would extend their resource advantage over public schools. There is no inherent entitlement to taxpayer funding of private schools. The only responsibility of government is to ensure that children are not deprived of an adequate education because they attend a private school whose total resources are less than the community resource standard. And there's one reply to the independent schools own up to major flaw in the private school funding model. One Jean Ely says on May the 27th, "This is very unusual indeed. But the independent school lobby have attacked Jane Caro on the parental bankruptcy figures according to the ABC Media Watch. Trevor Cobbold should be congratulated that there is very little, if any, pushback on his figures. The private school lobby is very fierce and can be nasty." Over to you, Jean.
Well, thanks very much, Andy. And Dale and I have just been discussing the jobs for the boys in the AFL and remembering how it used to be for people from the working classes very often. But the other side of it is, of course, who'd want the job? Who'd want the job of being a professional footballer these days after what's happened to people like Danaher and so on? Their life expectancy and their brain expectancy is somewhat shortened. Anyway, let's go across to America, shall we? And Jeff Bryant, who is a great public supporter, school supporter, has written a very interesting article on the Conservative plan to dismantle public schools, which he believes in America is entering the home stretch. And as you know very well, Australia has seems to be absolutely certain to follow America. So I'll pass over to Dale, who's got Jeff Bryant's article for us.
Thanks, Jean. The Conservative plan to dismantle public schools is entering the home stretch. This is an excerpt from Jeff Bryant's article. The full article can be found at the Independent Media Institute's website, independentmediainstitute.org/our schools. In what has been touted as the golden age of school choice, the option that is most popular with American families to fund and attend their local public schools is gradually being made less viable. Take North Carolina, for instance. For years, the Republican-dominated state legislature has chosen to cut the state's funding for public schools, resulting in a decline in inflation-adjusted per-student funding of about 13% since 2003, according to the NC Budget and Tax Center. The Education Law Center's ELC 2025 National Ranking of State Education Funding Making the Grade report shows that the Tar Heel State is dead last out of 51 states in school funding effort, a measure of PK-12 public education funding as a percentage of the state's overall economic capacity, its GDP. North Carolina spent $12,193 per student during the 2022-2023 school year. That's $5,660 less than the national average, states WRAL News, citing the report. The state also ranks 46th in teacher pay. A decades-long legal struggle to bring North Carolina's school funding levels in line with its constitutional requirement, resulting from a state Supreme Court ruling in the Leandro versus State of North Carolina case back in 1994, culminated in a decision by the current court. The state Supreme Court was taken over by a Republican majority and dismissed the Leandro ruling on procedural grounds with no possible recourse. North Carolina lawmakers have also ramped up efforts to redirect taxpayer dollars for education to private operators through charter schools and private schools that opt into the state's school voucher program. Thanks to the legislators' efforts to ease the process for opening and expanding charter schools, the percentage of students enrolled in charters has steadily increased, surpassing 10% since 2022-23, raising the state's rank for charter school growth to fourth in the nation, according to the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools 2025 enrollment brief. And since the state opened its school voucher program to all families in 2023, North Carolina ranks 7th in voucher usage, with 3.4% of the state's public K-12 expenditures going to vouchers, an annual expenditure of $624 million based on the 2026 rankings by EdChoice. Not satisfied with these efforts to defund public schools, North Carolina lawmakers are now considering legislation to cap local property taxes, an important source for funding public schools in the state. Property taxes provide revenue for critical local services like public schools. Joanna Lefebvre, a policy analyst for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, tells Our Schools in an email. Property taxes are one of the most stable sources of revenue because they are insulated from economic downturns. In North Carolina, state funding accounts for 60% of school resources, while local funding, mostly from property taxes, contributes 23%. The federal government chips in only 17%. Despite the importance of property taxes as a revenue source for public schools, Republican lawmakers passed a bill to place a constitutional amendment on the November 2026 ballot that would give the state legislature the power to limit property tax increases. In Mecklenburg County, the state's second most populous county, which includes Charlotte, State Assembly member Brandon Lofton tells NC Newsline that the county has spent about $2.9 billion on items that are the state's responsibility, resulting in 700 teaching positions being funded completely by the county. In Orange County, one of North Carolina's wealthiest counties, the county budget for the fiscal year of 2027 is being hit with a barrage of higher costs, including the federal government's decision to slash reimbursements for food benefits for low-income families, known as SNAP. County officials blame state and federal funding cuts and persistent inflation for these increases. If these efforts to defund public schools seem like a coordinated campaign, that's because it is, and North Carolina's not the only state where this campaign is rolling out. Carol Burris, Executive Director of the Network for Public Education, a nonprofit that advocates for public schools, points to a common project among many states, mostly governed by Republican majorities, that are seeking to end democratically governed public education, she writes in an email to Our Schools. Under the guise of school choice, Burris says, they will eventually narrow choice for the majority of American families. The agenda was never hidden. Create a school marketplace, then shift the burden from the public to families. This plan, according to Burris, drew its initial inspiration from the writings of the late economist Milton Friedman, who argued that education and other public services should be purchased as consumer goods in a commercial marketplace rather than provided as taxpayer-supported service, which is publicly governed as an essential infrastructure accessible to everyone. It's easy to see how Friedman's doctrine would be hugely popular with the wealthy, who resent paying taxes for services other people use. Now, under the federal ascendancy of the Trump administration and state legislatures that are gerrymandered to ensure decades-long conservative rule, the campaign to dismantle public education appears to be entering its home stretch. In February 2026, Fox Business reported that five states were considering repeals of property taxes that generate 90% of school funding for local districts in those states. Some of these efforts have died in committee or failed during a floor vote, but a few have moved forward and have since been joined by newer efforts in other states to either curtail or end property taxes. Regardless of the details, the goal is to end or severely limit one of the primary funding sources for public schools. The goal has been long in the making. As the Institute of Tax and Economic Policy, ITEP, explains in a 2025 report, a once popular tax revolt in the 1970s and 80s resulted in over a dozen states enacting measures that limited local government's ability to tax property fairly and accurately. These property tax cuts and caps have devastating impacts on school funding. CBPP's Lefebvre explains, citing California's property tax cap policy known as Proposition 13. That measure, passed in 1978, resulted in per pupil funding declining from 18% above the national average to below average, according to her. Funding levels didn't recover until 2017. Consequently, academic achievement declined and continues to lag national averages, and the state has one of the highest student-teacher ratios in the country, thanks to the policy, which is still in place, she says. Lefebvre continues, research suggests that property tax cuts and caps lead to increased student-teacher ratios, reduction in new teacher qualifications, and decline in students' reading and math test scores. Instead of hamstringing local government's ability to raise revenue through property tax cuts and caps, Lefebvre says, states should support localities' flexibility to raise sufficient revenue to invest in excellent public schools. In Ohio, also ruled by a Republican majority, state lawmakers have dramatically reduced state funding for schools while rolling out privatization efforts such as charter schools and vouchers. While the state's effort to adequately fund its schools is not rock bottom, it barely clears the level, earning a C rating. In 2025, state lawmakers passed a flat income tax and abandoned their previously adopted plan to bring funding levels for high poverty school districts more in line with their wealthier school districts. As a result, the state's contribution to funding public education will decline from 47% in 2019 to just 32% in 2027. And Ohio has fallen from 35th nationally in the state share of K-12 revenue in 2002 to 45th in 2023. On the privatization front, Ohio is somewhat ahead of North Carolina, with 4.2% of the state's students receiving some kind of voucher to attend a private school or homeschool. There are also a large number of charter schools in Ohio, with 318 in 2020 to 2021, compared to 202 in North Carolina for the same period. Both states enrolled about the same number of students in charter schools in 2020 to 21, 119,100 in Ohio, compared to 125,913 in North Carolina. But Ohio's privately operated school sector may have an even more negative impact on school funding, especially in the state's largest districts. In 8 major urban districts, 80% of state education funding goes to privately run schools. These efforts by Ohio lawmakers to undermine the state's funding for public schools have put pressure on local governments to steeply raise property taxes, resulting in Ohio having the 8th highest property tax rate in the US. Indiana is another Midwestern state where a combination of state funding cuts and school privatization efforts is putting more pressure on local governments to raise property taxes, which has, in turn, prompted calls for property tax repeals. The state earned a D rating on ELC's funding effort report card. Indiana does not have a large number of charter schools, except in Indianapolis, where 62% of students are enrolled in charters. It, however, has a slightly higher percentage of students accepting school voucher money than North Carolina. The idea that revenue lost by capping or eliminating property taxes can be simply swapped out for sales tax increases is an especially unfair tax policy. The analysis found property taxes are especially important for funding public services because they are the most stable of the 3 major taxes: income, sales, and property, even in the face of economic downturns. Also, property taxes are less regressive than sales taxes, which require a greater share of income from people with less financial means and a lower share from people who are well off. Regardless of these realities, Republican leadership in Indiana's state capital is proceeding full steam ahead. Florida is the poster child of the conservative movement's long game to end public education. The Sunshine State ranked 47th in ELC's funding effort analysis for 2023. It had the 3rd highest number of students enrolled in charter schools in 22-23, and the 4th highest percentage of students in these schools among all states. Meanwhile, it is number 1 in terms of the percentage of students using school vouchers. Florida state law already limits the annual increase in the assessed value, not market value, of homesteaded property. Nevertheless, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is leading an effort to eliminate property taxes completely for homesteaded residents. Taking their cues from DeSantis, Republican lawmakers in the Florida legislature are moving with a bill that would place a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2028, ending all property tax. A 2025 study by the Florida Policy Institute found that should the ballot referendum succeed, Florida school districts will lose $7.7 billion. In districts that are already fiscally constrained, like Highlands County, eliminating all property taxes would cost $60 million, or about 25% of all revenue. The federal government, under the leadership of President Trump, is doing its part in the conservative campaign to dismantle public education. Trump's proposed FY 2027 budget would slash $8.5 billion in federal funding for certain K-12 programs, and his administration is blocking $2 billion in congressionally approved grants for public schools in 2026. His Department of Education, under the leadership of Secretary of Education Linda McMahon, has withheld millions in federal funding for its full-service community schools program, as well as grants for special education, while expanding $60 million in grants to charter schools. In 2027, a nationwide federal school voucher program, which Trump pushed for and was approved by a Republican majority in Congress, will divert billions in funding from the U.S. Treasury to school vouchers, while harming funding for public schools. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks, Dale. That's pretty meaty stuff, isn't it? Let's have a break.
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up
with gasoline.
Fidel Castro. It's radiothon time again. This year, the Dogs have a target of $4,500. If you're able to pledge a donation to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call during business hours 03 9419 8377, or go to the 3CR website for more details, 3cr.org.au. You can pledge now and pay later. All donations over $2 are tax deductible. Help keep 3CR and the Dogs on air for another year.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Hope you're still listening to the Dogs, and we've got a short budget item for you to consider. We've had Mr. Chalmers and Mr. Albanese and all the others, Mr. Abbott and company, ad nauseam on the budget, haven't we? And capital gains tax and one thing or another. But nobody's talking about money for public education or for students at university. Here's a little snippet for you.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Guardian by Krishani Danji. Students would save $3 billion over a decade if Labor changed HECS indexation date by 5 months. University graduates would save more than $3 billion over a decade if the government changed the date of indexation on HECS debts, dubbed a broken system in its current form by Independent MP Monique Ryan. About 3 million students and graduates will see their HECS debts increase by a combined $1 billion on Monday when they are indexed by 2.8%. HECS debts do not accrue interest but increase yearly based on the rate of inflation or the wage price index to maintain the real value of the money owed. Students make compulsory payments towards their HECS, which are collected and held by the tax office, but that money is not deducted from the debt until the person has filed their tax return. That is done after the debt indexes. Costings by the Parliamentary Budget Office, seen by Guardian Australia, show if the government changed the indexation date from June 1st to November 1st, after compulsory payments have been paid down, it would cost the budget's underlying cash balance $1.2 billion in foregone revenue over 4 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, many thanks. Although the Labor are shortchanging public education, there's very little comfort to be found with the Coalition or the would-be Prime Minister, Ms. Hanson. But the Coalition, of course, can't see past the private schools, particularly the rather conservative Christian ones, and they have confirmed support for religious freedom in these schools, which really involves discrimination on the basis of religion, in spite of the fact that these schools are now getting more public money than public schools. Let's hear about this, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Coalition confirms support for religious freedom in schools. Julian Lisa, ABC News. The Coalition is defending religious freedom in schools and pinning soaring private school fees on the Albanese government's inflationary public spending. Source, The Australian. Unveiling the Coalition's private schooling policy last night, opposition education spokesman Julian Lisa defended the right of religious schools to discriminate on the grounds of religious belief. Criticising Labor and the Greens for consistently attacking religious freedom and religious schools, Mr. Lisa backed legal rights for private schools to hire and fire teachers and enrol students based on religious doctrine. Unlike Labor, we will never indulge the fantasies of the Law Reform Commission who wanted to attack your very identity as Christian schools, Mr. Lisa said in a speech to Christian Schools Australia last night. We believe in parental choice, institutional autonomy, freedom of religion, and that schools with a faith mission should be able to remain genuinely faithful to that mission. Religious freedom is about allowing schools not just to teach but to model the doctrines of their faith without the threat of litigation. Religious schools want to educate, not litigate. The Australian Law Reform Commission recommended in 2024 that religious schools lose their Sex Discrimination Act exemption, which allows them to expel LGBTQIA+ students or sack teachers on the grounds of their sexuality, gender identity, or marital status. Teachers can be dismissed for being divorced or living with an unmarried partner, or if they are transgender or homosexual. The Commission had advised the federal government to amend the Fair Work Act to permit faith-based schools to give preference to hiring teachers who share their faith. The Albanese government shelved the changes after failing to reach bipartisan agreement with the coalition. Mr. Lisa told the gathering that the coalition will fight for parents to have the right to choose authentic, caring Christian communities where students can learn and experience the marriage of faith and reason in accordance with the faith of their family. He also defended tax deductions for donations to school building funds. Back to you, Jane.
Well, look, thank you very much, Andy. And you can see why, listeners, the Dogs are pro-public schools, because public schools are open for all students, all parents, all teachers, and all cleaners, and all principals. Public schools aren't interested in the private lives and private preferences of their employees and students and parents. That's not relevant to education. But let's have some international news, shall we?
Good afternoon, listeners. This week we're going to look at the commodification of education, the big business it's become, and the people who are promoting it. Firstly, I'm going to do an article. This is by Adam Laats, L-A-A-T-S, in Slate magazine, which is an online cultural left-liberal-leaning online magazine from the States. It says, "Wave goodbye to the last normal year for American schools. Thanks to Trump's big, beautiful bill, the 26-27 school year will look wildly different. As schools send children home for the summer, we need to recognise a frightening fact. This could be the last year of public schooling the way we've known it. Donald Trump's new school funding scheme, pushed through as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, will kick in during the middle of the next school year in January 2027. It's going to create a financial tsunami for public schools. The real tragedy is that there's no mystery to it. We already know what will happen because the scheme is not really news at all. It brings us back to the bad old days, to the failed and inadequate divided school budgets from before the Civil War. Trump's plan brings back the devastating problem that our modern public school systems were designed to fix. The new program has been called a national voucher system, but in fact it's more like a private school subsidy. Here's how it will work. Taxpayers will be able to deduct up to $1,700 each from their federal taxes, whether or not they have children in schools. They can send that money, a dollar-for-dollar reduction in their federal taxes, to scholarship-granting organisations. Those SGOs, in turn, will distribute money to families to use for educational services, such as tuition discounts at private schools. Not every family will benefit. SGOs can give money only to families who earn under 300% of their area's median family income. It's also important is that the states will have to opt in, and every state will have to have some say in deciding which SGOs can participate. So far, we have 29 states officially signed up, and a complicated political back and forth going on in the rest. It's very different from the traditional voucher programs that started in the 1990s. Unlike vouchers, the money goes to the SGOs, not directly to families. Most crucially, the money will not be coming directly out of state education budgets. It will come from federal coffers, and that fact has tempted some Democratic governors, such as New York's Kathy Hochul, to flirt with the idea of opting in. At the school district level, however, the potential budget damage could be severe. Every student who leaves their local public school to take the subsidised private education will take their state funding away with them. School budgets are cumbersome to change, with many fixed costs, such as buildings and personnel. Even if the number of students at public schools drops suddenly due to Trump's private school subsidy, along with the funding that accompanies them, it will take time for schools' financial liabilities to go down accordingly. Principals and teachers get the same salary whether their school has 500 students or 300. Buses cost the same whether they transport 100 students or 50. Furnaces cost the same whether they warm 1,000 students or 300. It's a frightening prospect. Funding will drop off a fiscal cliff, but costs will stay the same, for the short term at least. The money has to come from somewhere, so districts will be forced to cut basic educational services. As public schools totter, more families might be tempted to take the subsidy and leave public schools, creating a dizzying budgetary downward cycle. To be sure, Trump's subsidy will provide a bonanza for some, large established private schools with existing fundraising infrastructure, could see a huge cash infusion. The new law doesn't limit the amount of benefits families can receive, so theoretically a school could pocket sky-high tuition, paid for with Trump's subsidy. And just as with traditional state-funded vouchers, some affluent families who already attend public schools could receive a significant subsidy. In my upstate hometown of Binghamton, New York, the 300% median income limit would include families making up to $190,000 per year. In such a city as Alexandria, Virginia, the cap would jump to almost $341,000. The very wealthiest families would be excluded, but there are plenty of well-off families who could participate. There's still a lot of unanswered questions. What may be most important is that we don't know which states will opt in. The states that do will have to decide what kinds of scholarship-granting organisations can take part, but we're not sure yet what the rules will be. States could, possibly, cut out certain types of schools or certain types of programs. For example, a state could insist that participating SGOs observe public school anti-discrimination laws, or they might not be able to. We just don't know. We also don't know how many taxpayers will take advantage of the program. There will be 138 million people eligible, but it seems unlikely they will all take part, given the filing requirements. Even if only a fraction of taxpayers participated in the new program, though, the cost could be staggering. For instance, if 48 million taxpayers gave their $1,700 to private schools instead of to the federal government, the reduction in the amount of money the federal government receives in income taxes would be more than the entire current budget of the Education Department. Would the money come out of the education budget, or serve as another excuse to cut that department's funding? We don't know, and we won't know until it's too late. It's just as important we have no idea if this radical funding scheme will survive after Trump's presidency. For private schools thinking about expanding their fundraising systems to take advantage, that uncertainty will likely serve as a hard break. Like businesses trying to negotiate Trump's erratic tariffs, private schools might not want to invest in a short-lived experiment. But even given all the uncertainty, there's no doubt that this subsidy will devastate public schools, if only in the short term. Like other choice programs, the hardest hit districts will be in rural areas, including those in red states. In Texas, for instance, staunch conservative legislators have defied Trump and ardently opposed the expansion of voucher plans because of the ruinous impact on their public schools' budgets. And in other red states like Alabama, existing cuts to federal education spending have decimated school budgets in rural areas, harming Trump's most dedicated fans. There are a lot of question marks about how the specifics will play out, but we do know how this will play out in general because we've been here before. For the first 50 years of the United States' existence, all public school limped along financially, hamstrung by the kinds of subsidies Trump is bringing back. In those early years, every state split up their education budgets among a variety of schools. They sent dribs and drabs to a variety of private schools and subsidised academies. They sent the never enough remainder to public schools. It was worse for everyone everywhere. New York City's experience shows the dangers. Through 1825, the city split up its state funding among a wide variety of public and private schools. In 1824, for instance, the city sent a measly $16.38 to the School of Christ Protestant Episcopal Church to teach 12 students. It paid $554.19 to educate 406 school children at the Catholic St. Patrick's Cathedral School. After 21 private schools got their cut, the remainder went to public schools. It was not enough to pay for a decent education at any of the schools, public or private. Worst of all, given the financial disincentives, there simply weren't enough schools for New York's children. Of the city's 30,560 children, school leaders found only 21,866 attended any school at all. It didn't fix all their problems, but in 1826, the New York City leaders opted out of their private school subsidies. They sent their entire state education budget to the city's public schools. By eliminating double costs for buildings, teachers and supplies, the city was able to offer more schooling for more students in the expanding public school system. By the 1840s, Horace Mann of Massachusetts hoped to copy the New York program in his state. As the state's first Secretary of Education, Mann painstakingly collected statistics to prove to voters how damaging the subsidies were. With two separate school systems, one public, one private, most districts could afford to offer only 6 months of public schooling a year. Parents who wanted more schooling had to subsidise it out of pocket. Mann persuaded voters to increase their own taxes by a smaller amount than those out-of-pocket fees, and used the money to provide 10 months of public school per year. There was enough left over to provide training for teachers, to increase teacher pay, improve school buildings and offer free textbooks. Due to the obvious benefits, in the decades before the Civil War, voters across the northern United States opted out of private school subsidies. In the South, however, states continued to subsidise private schools and academies, in part to ensure that the benefits of public schooling would not spill over to educate enslaved Southerners. We can see the results, and they serve as a stark warning from the past about our educational future. States that continued private school subsidies had far worse educational outcomes. In 1840, in Massachusetts, for example, just over 1% of white adult males were illiterate. Back then, the census did not ask about literacy amongst non-white Americans. In New York, just under 4%. In a highly privatised Georgia, in contrast, the number was 19%. In North Carolina, which also continued to use its education budget to subsidise private schools, the number was 27% of illiterate adults. Certainly those numbers reflect other factors, including the legacy of Puritan emphasis on literacy and the overall increased education funding in the North. Yet we cannot ignore the facts of the case. States that split up their education funding among private and public schools consistently offered far worse education to all. Now Trump's budgetary wrecking ball threatens to return us to those dismal conditions. He's using federal dollars, not state ones, to sweeten the deal. But in the end, the result will be the same. The cause will be the same too. No one will be able to say we didn't see it coming. I thought that was just an excellent historical perspective on state funding versus private school funding and how it plays out in the long term. Anyway, with that, I'm going to wish you a really nice weekend. Bye-bye.
Well, many thanks, Jeff. It's always interesting to go overseas, isn't it? And he takes us to interesting places. But let's have a break, shall we?
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because this is the best part of it. The earlier part, it was a bit depressing, I'm sorry. Things are not good for public education in our democracies at the moment, because our democracies are in trouble. But there's still a lot of good work going on, and our public schools are still the best. Any private school is only ever just not up to scratch when it comes to public education. But the Australian Education Union celebrated Public Education Day on May the 28th with some very interesting interviews. One of them was with author Kathy Litt talking to her favourite teacher. And we thought you'd like to hear who this favourite teacher was and let him speak for himself. So let's hear it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Celebrating public education. On the 28th of May, we celebrated National Public Education Day, a time to recognise the central role that public schools, preschools and TAFE institutes play in strengthening the social, economic and cultural fabric of our society. The AEU was marking National Public Education Day with the launch of Class Acts, a documentary series about the power of public education. This heartwarming series features the personal stories of high-profile Australians and how public education shaped their lives. AEU Federal President Corinna Haythorpe said the documentary reveals the less well-known life story of the teacher that made a difference to their lives and culminates in a reunion of the interviewee and the teacher. Public Education Day is a day to celebrate Australia's public education system, the teachers, principals and education support staff that work within the system, and the students that attend public schools, preschools and TAFE, Ms. Haythorpe said. It is a day to recommit to properly valuing and supporting public education in every community across Australia. The documentary series Class Acts provides an opportunity to showcase the positive impact of Australia's public education system and publicly reinforce Australia's world-class public education system. The documentary profiles many Australians, including Larissa Berendt, AO, Craig Challen, Gina Chick, Peter Grest, Justin Hazelwood, Kathy Lett, and Professor Yalmay Yunupingu. Now, here's an excerpt from the first episode of Class Acts, which profiles English teacher Rob Adams, who taught for many years at Sylvania High School. Among his students was Kathy Lett.
And I think everybody's got one teacher who inspired them, and they can think back that where one stands out. And for me and my girlfriend, it was definitely Mr. Adams.
I'm Rob Adams. I spent 40 years as a teacher with the Department of Education, New South Wales.
As well as being a lifelong teacher in the public system, Rob's also a product of public education.
It gave me an education that my parents could never have afforded. I came from a working class family. Father was a panel beater, spray painter, and I certainly wouldn't be who I am without that opportunity. It sent me to a teacher's college where I came across wonderful people who opened my eyes.
Rob's teaching career eventually brought him to Sydney.
I started teaching at Sylvania High School in 1970. I taught Kathy in years 9 and 10, and I taught her English.
Mr. Adams won us over from the moment he walked in.
Look, I remember that she was a lively person. Very smart, very intelligent. She was fun. You need the sort of kids who will throw out a few challenges and get the other kids going. You had to be on your toes when you had Kathy in the class because she had a mischievous streak.
But for Kathy, Rob Adams' class offered something special.
He never made me feel small. He used to make me feel big, and it gave me confidence. And when I wrote my first novel, aged about 18, I don't know whether I would have had the confidence to have done that without his encouragement. What I loved about him is that he didn't talk down to us. From the minute he walked into the room, he treated us as equals. And he didn't judge us.
Over the years, many of Rob's former students wrote to him.
Some of these cards are the best references I've ever had. Better than anything written by a school inspector. I just wanted to add an extra thank you for all the time you put into teaching our 2 and 3 unit classes. You're a great teacher, a nice person, who somehow even managed to make Alexander Pope interesting. Best wishes to you and your family for the future. And that's from Tricia Thorgood. Yeah, I remember Tricia. She was one of my 3 unit students. Mr. Robert Adams, you are unlike any other English teacher I've ever had. You're a teacher, deputy principal, but the best thing you are is a good friend. Your student, Melissa Lataro, she was one of my Year 7 students. I do remember Melissa. To Mr. Adams, thank you for being such a great deputy and a great friend. I will miss you, sir. From Sarah Winders in Year 9. What I really like is a great friend. Now, when kids say you're a friend, they mean they recognise that you care about them. Chokes me up to read this. You know, and I was a deputy principal, so I was responsible for the much of the discipline in the school. You were seen as the tough guy, but they could see through that. And I like that. You have done a lot for this school and a lot for me. You really did have a good job here because you got to teach me. We will miss you. See you, sir, Kirsty. Now, Kirsty was a problem child. She was always in trouble, but she was a funny kid. Here's a kid that I would have disciplined any number of times, probably for being cheeky, for doing the wrong thing, probably smoking behind the toilet, who knows. But for all that, they know through it all you care about them, and I think that's important.
If you'd like to see the entire episode and series, you can go to www.classacts.tv. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks to that teacher and the AAU and the Class Act, which they've got up on their website. But it's the great state school now, and of course it's the obvious one that's here, shall we?
Every week on the Dogs Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school. School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Sylvania High School. A world of opportunities. We offer a wide range of programs and experiences to help them thrive. From STEM and sport to the creative and performing arts and more, our broad curriculum encourages curiosity and critical thinking. At Sylvania High School, academic excellence is not just a goal, it is embedded in everything we do. Parents choose our school because we deliver real, measurable growth and high achievement across all areas of the curriculum, underpinned by strong support, personalised learning, and consistent success. Sylvania High School offers a broad and exciting curriculum that encourages students to develop essential skills, knowledge and understanding. Our school has established a strong, dynamic and caring learning environment that focuses on engaging students by connecting their learning to the real world. These programs are delivered by a highly committed, talented and experienced team of teachers and support personnel who work collaboratively with students, parents and the broader community. A world of opportunities. We offer a wide range of programs and experiences to help them thrive. From STEM and sport to the creative and performing arts and more, our broad curriculum encourages curiosity and critical thinking. Tailored learning support. We know every child learns in their own way. That's why we provide tailored learning support to help each student do their best. Our programs meet different student needs. This includes high potential and gifted students, students with additional needs or disability, and those who need wellbeing support. A welcoming community. Our school is a place where students from all backgrounds feel safe, respected, and part of the community. We value diversity and fairness. Your child will learn and grow in a school that celebrates who they are. We prepare students to be confident, well-rounded, global citizens. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The current enrolment, 750. And the ICSEA value, slightly above average, 1,039, representing a diverse urban seaside community. The upper 25% of socio-educational advantage makes up 16% of students. The second quartile, 30% of students. The third quartile of socio-educational advantage, that is below 50%, is 34%, and the lowest quartile of SEA makes up 19% of students, with 48% having a language background other than English and 3% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $3.13 million and from the New South Wales Government, $11.9 million. Private fees at another $601,000 and other private contributions, $73,970. And that comes to $21,347 per pupil. The capital, $2.8 million over 3 years. And back to you, Jane.
Congratulations to Sylvania High School. But now the time is getting away from us, so it's up to me to remind you that Radiothon will be here in 2 weeks, and the dogs have got to raise nearly $5,000. So we're hoping that you will ring in to 3CR and pledge some money for the dogs program. I'd like to refer you to our website at www.adogs.info. But I'd like now to thank our wonderful producer Dale and her offsider Andy, and of course Jeff, and from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline.
Fidel Castro. It's Radiothon time again. This year, the dogs have a target of $4,500. If you're able to pledge a donation to help us reach our target, please contact the station. Call during business hours 03 9419 8377, or go to the 3CR website for more details, 3cr.org.au. You can pledge now and pay later. All donations over $2 are tax deductible. Help keep 3CR and the Dogs on air for another year.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.